book are not only better at their jobs, but are happier, healthier, and just better people. I read Kelly's book about 5 years ago, and that, along with Don't Make Me Think, were the two books that really inspired me and made me wanted to fully get into this whole web malarkey. Kelly is a champion of best practice. She fights for the rights of users, and she shows us that process really does make perfect. She's also my idol. It's an honour today to welcome to Webstock and to the stage Kelly Goto. And Kelly is sponsored by the great people at Provoke. Kelly.
Can you hear me? No. Let's see if I'm on here. Well, thank you guys so much for having me. And it's the afternoon, so I hope we can all stay awake through the afternoon. There we go.
Okay. Well, today I'm talking about something that we've been doing in our organization, which is really diving into the way people think, the way they live, desires and behaviors, all those things. And I was recently in Iceland at a conference. It was, you know, a little bit colder than it is here. And we were talking about getting into the lives of people and really understanding what they need on a regular basis. And someone came up to me and he said, well, you know what Henry Ford said? He said that if you had asked him to go out and talk to the people and ask them what they wanted, they would have said they wanted a faster horse, right? They wouldn't have known they wanted a car. So we're not only asking people what they want, but we're actually getting into their lives and understanding the needs and the behaviors behind what their desires are and what they understand. So today's presentation is about interface, designing for lifestyle. And I was recently flipping through this magazine. I picked it up at the airport, and it was great because it was talking about innovation. And it talks about Google, and it talks about Apple, and it talks about some of these companies. And Google, I don't know if you know, but they have 80% of their people spending, or no, they have this formula where they take 80% of the time and focus on what they're supposed to do, and then 20% of the time they're supposed to be focusing on innovation. So there's all kinds of interesting ways that people are driving their companies towards innovation. And I know that for all of you, you're trying to stay one step forward. You're working on your daily job. You're trying to figure out what to do on a regular basis. You're getting through your app design. You're getting your requirements out. You're getting your websites updated. You're dealing with the content management systems. But you're still thinking, how can we stay one step ahead of our competition? How are we going to keep our eyes focused on the future? So that's what today's session is all about. It's about creating innovation through understanding lifestyle. And it seems like a common theme through this conference, and I'm really glad to have heard the 5 minutes. I feel like an hour is a lot of time. I'm going to be speaking a little bit quickly because I often do, and I have a lot of information to cover. At the end, we'll have a little bit of time for Q&A, but I'm really hoping today to show you a peek at what's possible, to start off from a big picture, to kind of dive down into what we're doing on a daily basis so that you can have something to take back to your workplaces and maybe even start with tomorrow, or not tomorrow, but next week. Yeah. So innovation. When I flipped inside the magazine, I was shocked and surprised to see the word ethnography. Do you see it there in the header? Ethnographic research. And I've been talking about ethnography for a long time, but I haven't been using the E word, because it's a little bit of a mouthful. People think it's academia-based. They're a little bit scared of it. I coined the term design ethnographer for my own title because I thought it was appropriate. I looked in Wikipedia, and it's not there, so I'm thinking I better add it. So I'm a design ethnographer, self-proclaimed, and what I'm trying to do is integrate research and design into the overall process of development. So this is kind of interesting because it talks a little bit about what drives innovation and what are the main inhibitors of innovation. So here there was a list there, lengthy development times, lack of coordination, risk-averse culture, limited customer insight, poor idea selection, inadequate measurement tools, dearth of ideas, marketing or communication failure. And so we need to be addressing all these things within our organization in order to take that next leap ahead. What was really interesting about Iceland, and I think the same thing holds true with New Zealand to an extent, is that you do have a culture that's ready for change. It's fast to innovate. It's a controlled environment to the point where you can have a monopoly of a phone system come in and, you know, charge a lot of money. But at the same time, you have some control over your population, what they're looking at, how they're actually interacting with the systems that you produce on a regular basis. So I was really excited going through this article as it talked about how ethnography and research is really making a difference. This is something I've been involved with a long time. I start thinking about lifestyle-focused companies. One company that came about in the last few years in the States is JetBlue. And I don't know if you've heard of them, but JetBlue came out as a little-known entity. They have really strong branding. They're completely customer-focused. And David Needleham, who is the CEO, actually spends a lot of time talking about how their entire industry and the entire business is focused on customer needs. And it's really fantastic because as I fly JetBlue, I actually look forward to it. You get on the airplane, you have a seat that you have 24 channels, and these are really short runs. So they're $150 every, you know, one way. And I had an experience where I had to go to Washington, D.C., and I actually had to change my ticket. So I called customer service, and I said, I have to change my flight. And they said, no problem. So they changed the flight, and I expected them to say there's going to be a $100 change fee. But they said, oh, your new ticket's actually less expensive. So we're going to refund you $50. Wow. How does that work? And the other thing that's kind of funny is they don't serve food, so everyone brings a brown bag lunch, and you hear this rustling, and pretty soon people are sharing food. Some people bring tuna fish sandwiches, a little stinky. But, you know, it's an interesting culture that's changed, and everyone's very friendly, very happy. The other thing that JetBlue did is they took all of their employees and they gave them immediate stock benefits. So every single employee that works for the organization has a stake in the future of the company. So they really believe in that culture. Something shocking happened a few months ago. I was at the Mix conference, Microsoft's new design conference, the very first one, and it was in Vegas. And the really shocking thing was that the designers and developers that were there were happy. I know that sounds weird, and I'm from Seattle, coffee culture, very, you know, this feels like home to me. I was saying the other day that it was raining, I was having coffee, I felt like I was in Seattle. But what's interesting is the culture of Microsoft isn't necessarily known to be innovative or, you know, happy-making. People are often disgruntled previously when they've come from that organization. So I started asking people, what do you think is making the difference? Talking to these developers, they were really excited because they're doing some super innovative things. They highlighted the release of a new system. You know, it's called WPF, and I was calling it WTF. But it was pretty interesting because they're kind of talking about new ways of innovating their businesses. And I realized that there's Robert Scoble is someone who started blogging for Microsoft. And they started an open communication culture. Remember the little things that we just read that were causing companies not to be able to innovate? Communication is a big piece of it. So opening up communication between lines from the top down, instead of being a top-down, really heavy, you know, kind of weighted company, these companies now that are popping up are bottom-up. All the designers and developers have a voice. People are being heard, and they're actually really happy because they're able to innovate really quickly. So there's a lot we can learn. TiVo's another one. Do you guys have TiVo here? TiVo's great. Everyone that has TiVo absolutely loves it. They couldn't live their lives without it. They've actually tried to kill it in the States because it's so successful. TiVo really understands your lifestyle needs and behaviors. It watches what you watch on TV. It tries to give you suggestions, but it does it in a really unique way. And it actually serves a need that's a common need. We're gone a lot. We want to have our favorite shows recorded, but it does it in a way that's really unique and it's easy. I actually tried another system that I thought was a TiVo system, and it worked so terribly that I documented it just so I could write an article about how horrible one system was and how great the other. But what's happening is that TiVo is being killed because it's a little bit too good. And so that's a little bit sad. Google, you know. Apple, you know. And so these companies are sort of best practices. So JetBlue, again, walking through the JetBlue experience is as friendly as this kiosk that just says, howdy, how can I help you today? It's very friendly. The way that we're talking back from machine to human is very important. This is the example of TiVo. It's very friendly. It goes ba-doop, 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 and it almost sings a little song to you as you're flipping through it. It's extremely fun to use. Google has a lot of applications. Some of what I'm going to talk to you about today is the use of mobile devices as integrated with our lives, not just mobile separate, but how a lot of what we're seeing on the web is actually used in our mobile devices today, and we carry it around with us, and so it's a little bit of ubiquitous behavior. So GMAPS is an example of that. iPod we know, but I noticed that yesterday, I don't know if you guys noticed that Apple and Nike came out with a co-branded item. Did you hear this on the news yesterday? So it was pretty interesting because they took the iPod, obviously very popular, $1 billion worth of revenue since they launched, and they merged it with Nike's shoes, and so there's an actual system that merges with your iPod that tracks your exercise and how many steps you're taking, and it actually changes the music or gives you little beats, and it's going to be kind of a combined tool, and we'll see how that works. But talk about two lifestyle brands merging technology in a really unique way that actually works with our lifestyles. So why do I bring these examples up? I bring them up because I want us to continue to think outside the box. I want us to think all the time about the products and services that we use in our daily lives, not just the companies that we work for or the applications that we're developing, but what are we actually going to use, and the things that we can integrate into our lives are going to be the successful products and services of the future. So today I was mentioning the takeaways, and obviously one of them is I want to understand at a high level lifestyle branding and how these companies are actually innovating products and services. I also want to make sure that we understand that there's some new trends that are happening. One of them is called MoSoSo. Have any of you heard of that? Mobile social software. So social networking is huge, and in the mobile space, it's really picking up. And then I'm going to talk about rapid ethnography, and don't get scared by that term. It's really just deep hanging out, and how you can incorporate methods of rapid research into your development process. Now, I'm going to go through these slides. My system, you know, may crash. It's been crashing a little bit. We'll just switch over to that. He's following, right? You're following? Okay. And just in case there's a little glitch, but I want to actually try and get through as many examples as possible in this time frame. So a lot of what Joel was talking about this morning was right on. It was such an excellent presentation. And what he talked about was the emotional tie that we have with products and services. And so this is a coffee machine. You guys are a coffee culture. And you look at the practical side of things, you look at the emotional side of things. The coffee maker on the right side is actually a Francis coffee machine that I bought and used in my office. And does it look intuitive to you? Can you figure out how to use it? It's a little bit confusing. The interesting thing about this is I did a ton of research, and I looked at all those machines that tamp and ground out coffee in 90 seconds or less, 60 seconds or less, that used fresh beans, that did all these little mechanical things, and a friend of mine said, it's great if you're an IT person. And I said, no, I don't really want to deal with that in the morning. And so we, as an office, looked at a lot of different machines, and because we're designers, we had to get the Francis machine, and we learned how to use it. And as a ritual, a friend of mine named Lee Duncan came up with a term, and it's not her term, but she uses it quite often to talk about customer experience, is the rituals that we go through on a regular basis. It's not just a habit that we have, but it's actually ritual or behavior that gets into thinking about tribal and community and all these different things. But what are the rituals that you go through on a regular basis, both in your personal lives and also in your workplaces? What are rituals that we do when we get dressed in the morning, when we brush our teeth, when we wash our faces? What are rituals that we do when we get our coffee and we have to get the paper? And we establish these rituals in our life because they create comfort, and they actually become part of our overall experience. So you have to think a little bit about the practical versus the emotional. And we've been migrating a lot into the emotional experience, and that's why all of the social networking, the gaming theory, all these different ways to motivate people, because there's so much out there that we're confused. We don't just have a single choice of three, you know, TV channels anymore. We have satellite systems. We have all different kinds of music to listen to. At our workplace, we have many different softwares that we can download that will help us do sales. And all these things, how do we choose? We have to choose and pick the things that are actually going to be integrated into our lives and have emotional value. And so when you think about a product or service that you're creating, you have to think, are you emotionally attached to it? Do you think it's useful? It's actually more than just usability. Does it meet your needs? Can you integrate it into your life? There's also other aspects when you think about websites as to if it's returnable. Is this something when you come back to it, are you going to have a better experience than you did before? Is it learnable? Is it something you would recommend to a friend? A lot of things that we do, we have different touch points in the customer experience. So we actually have considered purchases, highly considered purchases, which is what we tend to specialize in, and impulsive purchases. So how many of you guys think that you have a product or service out there that is an impulsive purchase or an impulsive decision as you go through it? How many people think that you work on something that's a highly considered decision-making process? And I guess that there's not everyone is a product, right? So you have different services and products and you're selling things. And I guess let me just take actually a room read. How many of you out there consider yourselves designers? How many of you out there consider yourselves information designers? I didn't ask that question before. How many out there consider yourselves developers? How many are project managers? Strategists? Copywriters? Raise your hand if you do all sorts of things. You wear many hats. So a lot of us in the room wear many hats, and that's exactly what tends to happen, is that we have a process and a kind of a culture, even our own organizations, where we try and wear labels and put hats on, but in the end, we're all trying to meet many different needs. So it's kind of interesting, integrating things into your life, just because something is usable doesn't mean that it's meeting your audience's needs. So more than just usable. So I already told the story, and I said I wasn't going to say it again, and I lied. I'm so sorry. I'm going to talk about this one more time. This was an article I read about checking your engine light. How many of you guys have seen the check engine light on your car? Yeah? And when it comes on, do you listen to it? Do you actually respond? Yes? How many of you take it right to the dealership? And how many of you ignore it? So you know what's interesting is it depends on the situation and the model of the car and how accurate you think the computer system is. Sometimes you can just tap on it. Who dropped their iPod? And someone said they dropped their iPod and they just tapped on it and it got fixed. Maybe that was something I saw on TV. But this kind of low-tech thing that happens when you see an emergency light, you have to decide whether you're going to listen to the computer or not. So recently, probably about 3 years ago now, I was actually in a situation where the check engine light not only came on, but the entire car stopped in the middle of a freeway. So I had rented this Prius, which is the hybrid model, and I was driving down the 280 freeway near San Francisco, and I was thinking, wow, this is kind of cool. It's an interface. I wonder if this is going to crash on me. And I was talking to a friend of mine going, ha, 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 it's like a computer system. And all of a sudden, all the emergency lights went on. Every single light went on, and the entire car just stopped dead. And I was floating along in the middle of the freeway, unable to do my hazards, unable to roll down my windows, things like that. And so I had to choose whether to go right three lanes or dive to the left with cars going 80, 90 miles an hour past me. So I managed to find a hole, dived to the left. Long story short, the police ended up doing this zigzag serpentine thing and closed the entire highway so I could move safely over to the right side. And as I mentioned the other day, this is sadly the second time I've had to have a police force do that for me. And what ended up happening is they did a little tap, 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 put some gas in it, and it was just fine. So everyone said, oh, Kelly, you just ran out of gas. My parents said, oh, you know, those things happen to you. I don't know why they happen to you, but they just happen to you. Even my sister said, I'm sure you just didn't read the machine right. I said, you know what, even if I didn't, there's something wrong with that car. And I just kept saying there's something wrong with that car. And at first people thought I was insane. But shortly after, this came out where 13 cars, you know, were actually pulled and recalled because they actually shut down on highway speeds. And the next year, 75,000 cars were recalled. So it's definitely something that you need to think about. The products and services and applications that you're developing aren't necessarily going to be just for the internet anymore. They're going to be cross-platform. We talked just briefly this morning about microformats and how information is going to be more and more object-oriented and passed along to different devices, not just your computer, not just your mobile, not just your PDA, but maybe your GPS system on your car. And so we have to think more and more about the overall user experience as it pertains to our daily lives. So it's pretty amazing how you think about the impact of the things that you're doing. This was really interesting to me. I start thinking about human-to-human communication and how we've got that down pretty well. We can look at someone and we can see, make eye contact, you know, you sort of see if you're laughing or not, and you can tell what's going on. You interact with each other. It's pretty universal. We have machine-to-machine communication that's binary, XML, goes back and forth, data transfers really fast. We've got that down pretty well. We've kind of got the human-machine interaction down where we have input fields and we can actually interact with the machine in a pretty comprehensive way. But I think what we've tended to not deal with over time and we don't quite have down is this machine-to-human interaction. Machines aren't quite communicating to us in the most effective way possible. This is where we really have to work on language, response. Have you had the phone where you have this really friendly computer voice that says, hi, what number do you want to dial, or what city would you like to dial? And they've gotten more and more friendly up to a point. They're trying and trying and trying to mimic this human behavior. Have any of you guys heard of the Turing test? Alan Turing actually came up with this test in the 1950s, right? And his test was to have a person and a computer behind a closed door, and then you had a person with a computer screen. And the test was to see if the person could tell if they were talking to the human or if they were talking to the machine. And it was really interesting because they developed a whole system of response that made it very friendly and eventually called it Eliza. And it's on the web. And it's fascinating because his goal and his dream was that there would be a day when we wouldn't be able to tell the difference. Can you tell the difference if you're talking to a machine or a human? Pretty much. I think it would actually be scary the moment where you couldn't tell. But it's happening more and more that we, in dealing with interfaces and interaction layers and computers and everything that we do on a regular basis, we have to think about that machine-to-human communication and are we doing it effectively? Error messaging, everything else. So we've already been talking about emotional interfaces. Don Norman wrote a really great book on emotional design. And one of the things besides, you know, all the different motivators around happen to be personalization. They say that the person's name to them is the most important word. So if you think about personalization, anything that you can do to personalize the experience that you're creating for your customer is going to create a lot of motivation for them to continue. It's going to create loyalty. It's going to make them feel like you're creating something specifically for them, making it special. So here's some examples. This is a project called the Pandora. It stems from the Human Genome Music Project. Have any of you guys heard of that? And what's really amazing about it is that it's a little device, and I'll show it to you in a second, and it really listens to your needs and takes your music preferences, it takes your choices that you're making over time, and it shapes the music recommendations, just like Amazon would like to do, and it actually has links to be able to purchase and things like that. So it comes up with, when you listen to a song, you can say, why did you play this song? Well, it explains, you know, it has certain beats and tones that are similar to the thing that you started out with. It says, you know, make a new station, so you can actually create different stations according to your moods. It kind of gets into a little bit more about I like it, I don't like it, you can add it to your favorites. And then as you move through it, this thing pops up and it says, you know, great to hear from you, tell us what's on your mind. So it's a really friendly interface, and let's see if I can actually get it to pop up. So the beautiful thing about this is it's taking us through a wizard-like interface, something very common when you're trying to set up software or do something, and it's actually talking to us as if we're human and it's a friend of ours. So here's the Pandora project. It's loading, and everything exists in this little widget. And I do feel slightly guilty that I do not believe it's accessibility-oriented, and that is its own other layer. But as I bring this up, I think, okay, well, this is pretty interesting, and I don't know if the music's actually going to play, and we'll see if it plays up, but I can actually select a song, and it will play it, and then it will start to say, okay, guide us. And here it says, I really like this song, play more like it. And so then it'll give me more choices. Cool, we're glad you like it. We'll be sure to play more songs with similar musical qualities. And I can actually start to go through and listen to different music. And it'll take me through all these different examples and then decide if I like it. And it'll keep playing samples for me and switch it out. And the way that it interacts, someone I recently met with, it was a client that they have a lot of information that they're forcing people through when they're trying to sign people up. Have you gone through that? I just got the Vodafone phone card for using my mobile here. And it forced me to go through a sign up to get the last $10. And I tried to sign up, and you guys have a really weird street naming system. And I don't have that street system in the US. And so it wouldn't let me finish, and I couldn't get my $10, and it was super frustrating, and I finally ended up using the hotel address, and somehow that worked. But it didn't allow me to say whether I was from outside the US or not, and I thought that was a problem. But I'm going through this wizard, and all I'm doing is trying to send an SMS to Zeff to let him know that I want to have lunch. And that is my goal. You know, Joel was talking this morning about uploading a Flickr tool. Flickr image, and you start off with this really quick thing that you want to do, and you end up getting bogged down in all this wizard and, information that you have to share, and it gets stuck in all these problems. And so it's really important as you drive through that user experience, even if your business initiative forces you to ask certain questions and get information, you have to understand the real situation that people are in and how to make their lives better. Okay, so that's the Pandora project. So thinking a little bit further, this is something, I don't know if you guys use Skype a lot, but I use Skype a lot, and every once in a while I log in, here's someone from Poland that's 18 years old that wants to talk to me. Very odd, but I get a lot of these things, and I think that they're junk, and then all of a sudden I started getting them from people I knew, and I realized, no, these are really, somehow they find you, and I haven't quite gotten into the whole Skype world, but it's pretty amazing how global these experiences are and how you're interacting now with people and social situations far outside your norm. So this is Skype. This is something that I'm now starting to learn how to use a little bit more. And especially because we have clients, I have friends and a lot of people in different countries. So Skype really helps. And we've recently had a project where we had people in three different countries, Barcelona, Mexico, and the US, East and West Coast. And we had to use Skype to have cheap calls. And I'm sure you guys would be excited to have cheaper calls. And so it was really fun to see how this VoIP system is actually working and how it's affecting our business and the way we do business. So this is an example. I bring this up because there's something called mobile mashups, and the whole idea of mashups in web mashups also is combining things that are really cool that you use on a regular basis. So how many of you guys use Flickr? Okay, so everyone uses Flickr. Lots of people, well, if you don't, get on Flickr. So Flickr is really great. It's a great way to share information. Everyone's been talking about it today. And I just want to show you a couple things that some people have done. Because this is open source and people are allowed to actually tap in, someone brainstormed in Barcelona and came up with this. And what it is this is real-time people uploading images right now. These are the images that people are uploading. If someone uploaded something from Webstock, we might see it really quick. And it's really fascinating because this is just a little fun way to get us emotionally involved in an interface. Because it's something we already have out there, it's just a little API that we can tap into. It's pretty amazing. So there's also another one. This company is called Pim Pam Pum, I think. And it's a group of three guys, and they just are innovating new ways of doing things. And these are just some things that they happen to think of. So here we have a bubble maker. And we go, what is this? And so I type in Webstock. Okay. Well, let's see what happens. Hey, there's all the Webstock images. Well, what can I do with that? Well, I think I'll go this way, and I think I'll pick this, and I think I'll start with that. That's pretty cool. And now I'm going to add another one, and let's see, what can I pick from this? And so you can basically create a strip and tag it, and there's Mike. And what's Mike thinking? Let's see. So he's going, wow, I can't believe this week is actually happening, which is, I think, a lot of what he's thinking. So you can continue to do this and make a little strip and publish it and share it with your friends. And so again, a really unique, interesting way that you can take an interface and create something that's emotionally compelling, that's tied into our lifestyles, and it's actually something that may be usable. So that's pretty interesting. And continuing further, this is a program called DateLens. Now, I'm not going to run this. If at the end I have a little bit of time, I will, because I think this is what's crashing my computer. But it's a program that a friend of mine who works at Microsoft Research actually helped commission an educational system and how to use it. And it's a completely different way of thinking about how to interact with a calendar system. And if I can show it to you, I will. It's so dynamic. It's a zoom, zoom, zoom interface. The days and weeks and months keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger as you zoom into it. You can zoom out infinitely. You can zoom in. The pieces break apart as you scroll into it. It's absolutely amazing. And there's all these little things that you can do. And it's a download and it's a plug-in to Outlook. And it's really fun to use. And so I've been using this as my calendar system. And I'll run it again at the end if everything, goes well. I don't want to crash my machine. But it's not beautiful. It's not purely aesthetically pleasing, but it is really functional, and it does work, as I will show you later. So thinking about mobile social software, and again, this is just little things. I mean, there's so much information that you're getting today and tomorrow. These are just little bits and pieces. But thinking about a trend such as social networking, how is that going to affect your lives besides hopefully your personal lives? I don't know, and you'll be able to interact with more people around the world. Well, we get into MySpace, and how many of you either have heard of MySpace or you're on MySpace? Okay, MySpace is actually the number two site in the world right now. It's getting, I don't know, billions of hits or something. I mean, it's right behind Google, and it is a social revolution, not just a phenomenon. And so recently, I was kind of interviewing the CEO of a company called Helio, and I know there's Helio Cell here, which I'm confused as to how that may play out. I don't think you'll have a problem because you're in New Zealand, but Helio just launched, and it's the brainchild of Sky Dayton, who is the CEO of Earthlink, and a merging between them and a company out of Korea called SK Telecom. And what they've done is they've created a combination of a cell phone, MVNO, which is a multiple virtual network operator, and really what's happening with the social revolution, and they're tying the two together. So I signed up and got on there and met all kinds of people that I used to work with, and it really is amazing how many people are using MySpace. It's free. People sign up. There's a lot of controversy also. One person that I talked to a couple weeks ago was at a university, and as she was walking through the library, she noticed that almost every single computer was logged into MySpace. It's, to me, verging on an addiction. So it's pretty interesting to me to see how these types of things are going to shape up, because people are maybe getting distracted at work. There's a lot of companies already that don't allow personal email, that don't allow personal websites to be launched during the workday, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this combination of social networking and the spreading of it as a social revolution and also as a great new revenue source because of the way they can target and control the audience, it's going to be playing itself out. In the U.S., there were two 15-year-old girls who were, basically disappeared in the Bay Area about 6 months ago. And the tie that they found out that these two girls had is that they were both on MySpace talking to the same guy. So it's pretty interesting and scary about how these types of social networking things are tapping into our real lives. This is a friend of mine. This is her homepage. These are some of the pictures that she has on her site. I had puppies and dogs. Joel had puppies and dogs. I had these too. But I had to share these with you because this is a friend of mine actually created the little dog picture, and then he found this, and he's like, swear to God, I didn't create it, I just found it. So there's just a lot of also humorous sharing of imagery, just like we would, and it's replacing our email a little bit. So those are great. Mobilicious, do you guys use that? So there's also a mobile version of Mobilicious, so again, thinking about the migration of content into mobile and what's happening. Dodgeball is a new service that got launched at South by Southwest, which is a huge conference that we have in Austin every year. And everyone started to use it, and we were all dodgeballing each other. And what it is you sign up for it on the web, and it SMSs you, and then it tells you where your friends are and where they're gathering. And you start to think that's pretty cool, but how many times have you been near a friend's house, but you didn't want to call them, and if you ran into them, you'd be a little embarrassed that you didn't call them ahead of time? You know, things like that. So there's a lot of little faux pas things that are popping up because of this type of social networking and location-based systems. Recently, we started working with a company that's actually doing location-based tracking of their families. Okay, so this is targeting parents who want to know if their kid got home, if they got to school, how close they are to home, if they're at their friend's house. Maybe they're going to track their husbands, maybe they're going to track their wives. It's pretty interesting, but how many of you would want the ability to track your family and see where they were on a regular basis? And how many think of you think it's scary? Wow, that's amazing. It's a scary thing because tracking and GPS systems and RFID tags, all this location-based awareness, it's all happening. There's a lot of conversation in the U.S., especially about protecting privacy versus security. Clearly, it's a big issue. But more and more, these companies are launching. Disney is launching with it in the fall. It's a whole Disney family pack. And you can track your family as you track their phones, and they all have phone systems. Sprint has a family, Sprint Family Locator, they're calling it. So you can have a master phone and figure out where all the phones are in context to your phone. There's a lot of people that might be afraid that their kids are, you know, going to disappear, and so they tag them in a way. And as my sister said, unless you're talking about treating them like a dog and putting some kind of chip in their ear, it's not really going to work. because as I talked to a bunch of mothers and their kids, I found out that the age range really made a difference. I mean, this is where getting into context and actually talking to people as you have these ideas, there's a lot of companies that launch that if they spent the time actually getting out there and talking to their people, they could find new uses, they could find out demographic information and psychographic information that's really going to help refine their marketing. And maybe they don't have a bad idea, maybe they just need to refine it and redefine the way that they're creating it in their minds from a business perspective. So there's a lot of companies that we work with that have great ideas for business that don't actually get out there and talk to people. So Shozu is a one-touch photo uploading tool similar to Flickr. Places is a location-based system where you give your information and it tells you where you are wirelessly in the world, and it also is kind of a social networking tool. So merging research and design, this is really the thrust of everything that I'm trying to do right now. One of my role models is Genevieve Bell. And she's a cultural ethnographer, not a design ethnographer like I'm calling myself, but a real one. She's a PhD. She, you know, trained at Stanford. She's this really amazing woman who has spent years going in and really understanding how people live. For instance, Intel wanted to introduce, do you remember ever hearing about the interactive refrigerator or the computer-based refrigerator? So they wanted to launch this in China, huge market in China. So she went and did a lot of investigative research and found out that, wow, there's a couple differences between the Chinese market and the U.S. market. One is that in the home, the families don't really congregate in the kitchen like they do in the U.S., and maybe they do in New Zealand. The kitchen is someplace that just the mom or the women are going to work and cook. It's very small. They're not going to actually use the refrigerator like they do in the U.S. Another thing is the notion of home. You have a wireless network. And in the U.S., a home, the standard size, and I don't know how much this is in meters, but 2,200 square feet about is an average size for a home. And we found out that looking at the Asian markets, that the average home size is actually probably about a third of that. And so wireless networks are now invading into other people's space. A lot of them are high-rises. And so you really have to think about how the products and services that you're actually creating differ from culture to culture. How many of you guys develop products and services for countries or cultures or people or target audiences outside of New Zealand? So a few of you. So you have to take a few things into consideration. And it's pretty interesting to think about how the things that you actually take for granted are completely differently perceived when you go to a different place. So traditional research, you have the researchers over here. Traditionally, firms have engineers over here. They have designers over here. They have the researchers maybe over here, you know, up here. So there's a lot of disconnect between the organizations. And really what we're trying to do is get these disciplines together into research and design. So this digital lifestyle, this concept of user experience as it pertains to, you know, our lives, I think of it like this. First, you have the brand layer. So you have this perception layer. And this is how your company is being perceived. It's the first glance that people have. It's the aesthetics, everything that Joel was talking about, that sexiness, whatever it is that captures their attention, that's the first layer. It gets them to say, hey, I want to try this out. Maybe they've heard about it from a friend. Maybe it was a word-of-mouth reference. But they kind of get into it, and they start thinking about it. So the next layer is really the interaction layer. Now that they've decided that they're going to try it out, they actually try it. This is where usability testing, observational research, all of this comes into play. So you have this interaction layer, and it says, wow, is this working for me? You're really trying it out in real time. And the thing that usability tests often don't uncover is how people migrate and change over time. You try it one way, you try it another. A lot of companies assume that someone's going to come to their site, they're going to register and log in, they're going to enter all their information, they're going to download the thing, they're going to install it, and they're going to use it all in one flow. And that's not true. They may come to the website several times. I know a lot of companies also assume that people are going to come to their website and just check that out, but research shows that people often have 3 to 5 browsers open at once. They have multiple screens. They're maybe spending 5 seconds now on each screen going back and forth. People are multitasking. So you can't assume that people are even staying on your page for more than 5 or 10 seconds at a time. So it's pretty interesting how this interaction layer is so important and how usability testing and iterative testing, observational research, and lots of feedback is important to really understand, is this working? And then in the end, true integration. Is this going to work for me as a business process? Is this going to work for me as a download that I can actually use to interact with my computer and it's going to sync my PDA with my Outlook? Is this thing actually going to work? So if it does work, it integrates with your lives, and then you have a success. So more and more, because we're getting into this lovely 2.0 environment that we all hate to say that term, but we are developing products now. We are getting into the aesthetics of it and the functionality of it, even more than content-driven websites. We're building applications. And for the first time, designers are having to think like engineers. Engineers are going to have are dealing with the design layer in a way that they haven't before. And we're having to really share disciplines. So I started to think about how these things differ. And I often ask this question. I say, how many of you wash your hands when you leave the bathroom? So everybody, right? Everyone does. So that's really a focus group. That's what you think you might do in a situation. That's what you're swayed to do because other people around you are watching. Someone that you respect may be raising their hand so you'll agree with them because you want to, you know, make sure that they understand that you agree. And focus groups are great, but focus groups tell us what we think we might do in a situation. And often it's the best case scenario. So we get into questionnaires and asking people questions. And again, this is great. Sometimes surveys are great for statistical information. But it's not really until you get to the other side where you talk about usability, which is observational, and you get into ethnography, which is understanding how people live, that you get into the lifestyles. So between how people think and how people live is really the difference in how your product or service is going to be applied and if it's going to be successful or not. At work, at home, in your family environment, in your social lives, whatever you're playing with, all these things are going to interact and they're either going to work or they're not. So it's kind of important for you to think about all methods of research. And unlike purists like Jacob Nielsen and a couple others, they might yell at me from time to time, I actually believe in using multiple methods of research in a process. And so we often employ maybe 7 rounds of testing, really fast testing, or iterative design, card sorting is part of it. We build prototypes. We iterate. The flash prototyping that the Shift guy was talking about is so true. It's really important that you're getting things out there and iterating really quickly through the process. So the types of research that we're talking about, it's not just focus groups, it's not just surveys, and ethnographic, it's not truly ethnographic research, just so I can make it clear. I'm not a social scientist. I don't have a PhD. I haven't spent 7 years in school. It's ethnographic-based research where you're basing it on methods of observation, getting out there, being in people's lives, understanding where they work, where they live, and it's everything that's in context. So it's really about context and contextual inquiry, concept testing, everything else. And someone was asking me how it differed from maybe how we do it now. And I think about it like this. Traditionally, you have functional requirements that are set. You go through assumed tasks through use cases. You make the functional specs. You hand it off to the developers. And you might do a prototype at that point. The difference in the methodology that I'm really trying to employ is putting that human being, that little, you know, stick figure person, at every phase of the project so that you're taking a look at them in the scenarios, in the paper prototyping, the beta, the release, and you're really getting feedback from them during this process. And for some of you, I know it might be hard for you to get access to your customer, but for most of you, I think you're dealing with intranets and with groups that you actually have access to, am I right? So you should be able to access your audience and get them in front of the thing that you're building and testing. This is extreme programming. This is a methodology that was established called XP. Are you guys familiar with this at all? So I've been looking at this and thinking about this agile methodology and what agile means. And agile is quick, it's fluid, it's seamless, and it's something that's been around for a while. And I was really excited to employ, sort of take methods and bits and pieces of agile methodology and apply it to web design and really talk about iterations. And I looked at this and I thought, ew, this is so ugly, you know? And I decided I would create kind of my own version of what that means to me. So I created this just to show you and give you a visual example of what I'm trying to achieve through lifestyle-oriented research. And so you start off, this thing builds, and it's really pretty, and you start to think about lifestyle. And your goal is to incorporate whatever you're building into someone's lifestyle, to deal with their needs, desires, and that's really the goal. But it's a little lofty, and it's kind of up there. So the next thing you do is take a look at your business needs and requirements. Oh, you're a little bit bogged down by this. You have all the stuff that has to happen, and you have to implement it. You may actually be a smaller company that has investors. you may have other requirements that are in play that aren't really dealing with your end customer's behavior or your own engineering abilities. And then you have the prototype, and this can come from the design side or the engineering side, but it's something that's feasible, it's functionally oriented, it's live, so you really get it up. A lot of you guys have what I would call a 1.0 web app or web experience that you need to refine. So what do? We have to incorporate methods of usability testing, contextual inquiry, heuristic analysis, and I believe in training everyone on your team so that you guys can do these things internally, and there's some great training courses. I'm so glad for those of you who are able to take the one day that I gave and Kathy Sierra gave. I think it gives you a lot of information and lets you know that, yes, you guys can get out there and do this type of thing yourself, but there's also resources out there. There's a lot of groups that do this kind of research, and you know what? There's nothing better in every situation than bringing in an expert that not only can identify the problems but can help you create solutions for them and do it from an outside perspective with the user in mind. So that's really what this method follows, and it's not new and it's not this fabulous newfangled thing that I'm trying to actually create. I'm just saying do it. Just like the book, originally the book came out and there were 5 steps and someone emailed me and said, you know what, this is so duh. I can't believe you're actually writing about this. And I said, well, how often do you actually follow a process when you're doing a project? And the person said, ooh, you're right. And how often have you done a project where you knew that you were supposed to do it a certain way, but it was super fast turn, and you had to get through it really quick, and so you kind of skipped steps along the way and had to backtrack? So we do that all the time in our own organization, where we end up having to backtrack over and over again because we skip steps. So just following through with this process until the very end result is actually that you're following this lifestyle-driven behavior. Whoops. So lifestyle is the goal. And again, there's a lot of other words that are out there in terms of making something a success, but that's really what we're trying to get to. So I think that this is a good example of a methodology that should be and can continue to evolve within your organization. So this is an example of looking at something from a non-US point of view, a non-New Zealand point of view, if needed. And this is a project that we actually did. I'm going to show you a couple projects. One is this global research that we did, and another one is actually this project that we just finished for a call center down in Mexico. So the first thing is taking a look at things from a non-US perspective. And it was pretty interesting because we just followed this process, and it was the same as a normal usability test or any kind of contextual inquiry where you have a goal, you screen participants, you observe, and we added a photo diary, which is kind of a fun component. We followed up and compiled a report. So this is something that you can do in about a week or 2 weeks, where you actually get out there and you do a 2-hour observation, you ask questions, do a brainstorm, figure out how they're using your product service in their regular lives, and then you ask them to take a photo diary of their lives, their homes, and you really understand how they live. Now, this becomes more and more important. And in context, one time I was doing a test on a screen reader for a book company, and we interviewed all kinds of different people. And one of them was a 76-year-old man that was taking care of his wife that was dying of cancer at home. He had one line, a 288 modem. And we were asking him to download a bunch of information using that line and keep it open while he read a book online. And we really thought in the perfect scenario with a person that had high-speed access, this would be no problem. But as we started to get into his life and understand some of the difficulties that he had, we realized how much we needed to streamline the experience, make the type bigger so he could read it, create it so the pages would flip really easily at the touch of a button instead of having to peek at a little tiny cursor or item on the menu. And we realized more and more that we needed to create this experience so that this man could have a positive experience relating to just one persona that we created. And it really changed the way we thought about the interface that we were creating. So Mobile Lives is an example of a Finland company. It's a Singaporean company and a US-based company, which was GoToMedia. And what we did was we decided that we wanted to take a snapshot into people's lives. The really great thing also about this kind of rapid ethnography is it doesn't take years to do. It's something where you can take a snapshot. You can also get your team out of the office. I mean, how great is it just to have a couple days where you guys are out of your norm, you're learning new things, you're going to be able to go back to your office and run with new ideas. Some things are going to inspire you to action. So it's really great to keep your office and keep all of your employees churning with ideas. One of the things I often suggest is to spend at least 1 day per quarter actually getting out there. And so making sure that you know who your audience is and letting your team go out there and interview them for an hour or two and let them watch them use the product or service that you're creating, interact with the website, and really understand, is it working for them or not? So this is David. He's 39. He works, you know, from home, and here's his life. And you are able to get a quick snapshot of some of the things that he does. And he's this slow-to-start American. And it's really interesting for us to take a look at what's going on with America and how slow we are to adopt because of the way that we're spread out, and also how comfortable we are with our current technologies and how unwilling we are to change. Do you guys feel that in New Zealand, people are basically willing to change pretty easily? Okay, or hard to get them to change their behaviors and habits? Okay, let's try that again. How many people think that it's easy to get New Zealanders to change their behaviors and habits? And how many think it's very hard to get them to change their behaviors and habits? So maybe it's half and half, because in the US, it's very difficult because people get used to certain things. They have all of their things set up just right. They're not really willing to try new technologies and new interfaces and new computers. They want to stick to something that's working when it works. This is Yiling, and she's in China. And she's in Singapore. And she has two mobiles and a landline. It's really interesting because as we got into Asia, it's faster and faster and faster in terms of the technology and the pickup. And you guys have heard this before, but we wanted to really understand why. So we start getting into her life a little bit more, and we find out that she has a fashion phone that's an accessory, and then she has one that has a cheaper calling plan. When I first came to New Zealand a couple years ago, or actually I've been here several times, I was shocked at how expensive it was, of course, to make calls from a landline or from mobile to mobile. And it was pretty interesting to me how everyone sent SMS to each other. Isn't it something like 75 cents a minute or something like that? It's just really crazy how expensive it is. So most of you guys use your phones, right, to send SMSs to each other, and you rarely make calls. Is that true? Yes, basically. So as an example, someone came from Germany, and she came to the US, and she said, oh my God, how is it that you guys don't pay to make phone calls from a landline? She goes, if we had these calling plans, I'd be on the phone all the time. So the other thing that happens in the US that we realize is that there's different ways that calling plans are structured, and there's flat rates and all of these things that make it much easier for the US citizens not to use SMS. They're not forced to, so they make calls. And so SMS, although it's the big rage in Asia, isn't necessarily going to be a big rage in America. Jonas is from Finland, and he's pretty basic. He lives a pretty basic life, and he's on his phone, but it's really a mobile. So we found out that in the US, it's still really called a cell phone. Is that 5 or is that 15? 5. Oh, my God. Okay, I'll hurry. So basically, in the US, it's phone calls only. People actually have flat rate plans, you know, things like that. In Singapore, it's a mobile device. They actually use it for data, they use it for a lot of things, and they have this kind of always-on culture also in Singapore, where they're always connected, they're always available, and it's a completely different work culture. In Finland, it's a mobile phone, it's still considered a phone. So those were some of the interesting things that we got in just this week's worth of interviews. We were able to take a snapshot, and I'm actually conducting another sample study right now with 2,500 surveyors to get some statistics about mobile content and services, and then we're going to follow up with 5 people being interviewed one at a time. So this is a call center app, and I want to take you through this, and actually I'm going to go ahead and escape out and go into it. Well, actually, okay, first I'll start off this way just so that we can get through it. Uh-oh. And the call center app was a company in Mexico, and they actually started off by saying, okay, well, we want to shorten the time to calls. And so we went down and interviewed all these people down in Mexico, and we found out that what were their problems, what were their needs, what were their behaviors, and we actually watched them and also conducted one-on-one tests and also videotaped what they were doing. And so one of the things that we found out was, in going through the application process, is that they weren't really motivated to make shorter calls. They didn't really have a need. And so one of the things that we tried to do in our wireframing was think about what were their emotional needs, how can we motivate them to make their calls shorter. So we actually went through a process where we found out that they could think of it like gaming. And we introduced a call center time that showed up large on the top and that kind of took you through the time process and said who was the fastest caller of the week, or who was the person that generated the shortest calls in that month. And so you kind of have a ranking and rating system that would begin to mimic this kind of gaming attitude. And then we built this prototype, and it was really interesting because, like we were talking about earlier, let's see if this works, we actually wanted to see if this concept that we were coming up with was actually going to work. So we built this in Flash, and we were able to take this concept. And you know what was interesting about it is that we were able to mimic actual behavior as much as we could. Here, 10 seconds are passing already, 11 seconds, 12. And so I can kind of keep track of how much time I have left to talk right now. But it's very interesting because when you actually create a prototype, you deal with the functionality in a little bit of a different way. And I do agree with the person that was speaking from Shift that it's a really dynamic way to present material. So design for things to come, personal, portable, pedestrian, design, research. I have these, and I can make this presentation available online. I just wanted to end with a little story, and I told this story at the presentation I gave a couple days ago. But I want you to understand, a couple years ago, maybe it was 3 years ago, I started getting these little brown paper packages. And one of them said, "To Kelly," it had no return address. I opened it, and it was this Agatha Christie's murder mystery book. So I thought, oh, that's weird. So then I open another brown paper package I get the next day, and it's 39 Steps Alfred Hitchcock DVD. I'm thinking, this is really weird. So the next day, my roommate is starting to freak out a little bit. I get a book, it's called Breathing. I think, oh, good, I read the back, and it's about a couple that are going to a funeral. So I'm starting to think, oh, no, what is this all about? This is kind of weird. And so then I open the next day, and I finally find this little slip in one of them that says half.com. So I go to that website, log in, find the customer service area, and I say, you know, I don't know if this is a marketing ploy or a really sick joke, but I feel like someone's stalking me, and I kind of write down everything that's happening. I continue to get these books every day. They pop back with an email that says, "Thank you for your inquiry. We will reply to you within 72 hours. And I think I'm going to be dead within 72 hours. So we get to this point where Monday I get a phone call, and it's my best friend growing up. And she's laughing so hard that she's crying, and she calls me. She's like, "Kelly, I guess you didn't get my birthday card, did you?" And I said, "No, it's actually nowhere near my birthday. It's still 3 weeks away." She said, "Well, I just got a call from half.com saying that they're going to arrest me if I don't cease and desist." And I said, "Oh my God, this was you." And she said, "Well, in my mind, you know, I was going to the website and I was sending you all the books and things that I had just read, and I thought they'd be interesting. I, you know, wrote you a card and I asked them to mail that around your birthday." So in her mind, she had packaged up this nice little thing for my birthday. In my perspective, I was being stalked. So you have to understand that just because from a business you think that this is the way that your site's being perceived, it's not always ending up that way from the customer's perspective. So you really need to get out there and understand how your customers are thinking. So thank you very much.
Isn't she great? Thanks, Kelly. I'm now going to pass you over to Mike, who's going to introduce our next speaker.